The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. This is the fifth week, I think, broadcasting from my shed, so I hope you can hear us loud and clear. If you want to email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about a major bun fight in the science of smell. We're going to be speaking to a controversial researcher who claims that the way our noses work is completely different to the way everybody else believes it to be. So if you've ever wondered why baked bread smells so delicious and how you can pick up molecules from 2 kilometers away when there's a burning house, we're going to find out all about that. First up, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And from the comfort of their own homes, it's Double Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
We think we've flattened that curve so much that there is no peak, that we think we can go along at a low level and reduce it even further. And that's the good news. That's the impact that we've had from all of the work that everybody across society has done.
Last night on The Late Late, Tony Holohan, the chief medical officer, said, we have flattened the curve, we think. And we don't think there's a peak coming. And that is an amazing achievement for everyone on the island. And while any death because of COVID-19 is obviously an awful tragedy, we had feared much, much worse. And that sentence from Dr. Tony Holohan is such a relief to hear. And it means that the sacrifices that we're making, small though they may seem on a particular day over a long period of time, it is tricky to do what we're doing. It's fantastic to hear. So congratulations to everybody. Laura, what do you make of that? And this surely is good news.
Yeah, it's just honestly, Jonathan, it's phenomenal. And I just want to give a shout out to all of the Irish public. It actually makes me really honestly emotional because I think people have done so well. And I know some people are saying, oh, look, it wasn't as bad as we expected. That is because of what we've done. Yeah. And we need to be really proud of everyone here.
What worried me this morning was the fact that some people in South Korea had gone through the disease and now had been retested for it and it turned up positive again. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I suppose a really important reason to do this story, in my mind, is honestly to help reassure people. Now, I can't tell you 100% that this is not because these people have been reinfected by someone else, but I think that's probably the least likely scenario. So the story is that 163 people as of yesterday have been retested positive in Korea, having been tested negative. The important part is also that 61 of those people do have symptoms. They're mild symptoms, but they have symptoms. And there's also people in China coming back testing positive. And obviously the fear is that these people went out into the community, they encountered someone who had coronavirus and they became reinfected. And that is terrifying. And honestly, I think that that is probably the least likely scenario. Now, I cannot be 100% sure. No one can be 100% sure. So I can't absolutely assure people. But there are a lot of other scenarios that could have caused this. Obviously, the easiest thing is that there could be an error in the test or an error when the sample was being collected. It's probably a very small number of these people, but it's a possibility. The other thing is that people could be testing and picking up dead virus particles. The PCR that they use to test for these virus particles picks up parts of the particle. So it doesn't have to be a full live virus. Right. And certainly 6 of these 163 people, they were not able to cultivate the virus from them. So it was either dead or in numbers that were far too small to cultivate. So that's a very distinct possibility. The other possibility is that it's not a particularly black and white thing, people recovering from a virus. So because you test negative means that whatever sample they took at that moment when you felt much better, they did not pick up coronavirus. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a small amount of virus still in your blood and that when your immune system was suppressed from being so sick, it didn't come back and attack you again. And I think that that's a very likely scenario in a lot of these cases. People had very suppressed virus amounts, but it was still there. It's, for instance, when you have a bacterial infection, you take your antibiotics and you stop early because you think you're better, but there's a bit of bacteria sitting in there still, and it comes back. That's why you should take your antibiotics all the way through. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of these people who have the virus as well. And I think that that means that really it's the same virus that's continuing to infect them rather than them being completely well again. Also, there's a very small chance the virus could be dormant in people and reactivated, like with the herpes virus. Again, that's not as likely. But I think overall, people should be largely reassured. These people are infected very soon, 13 and a half days on average after they tested negative. It's very unlikely that they were infected by someone else. Overall, I think we should be largely reassured by this. You know, I can't 100% assure people, but I don't think it's as terrifying as it seems.
Why do you have that? I know there's a caveat of we don't know, but why is that unlikely? Why is it unlikely for a virus to reinfect somebody?
It's unlikely because the vast, vast majority of the time when someone is infected by a virus or by a bacteria, they gain a form of immunity, usually in the form of antibodies. And we're finding people have got these antibodies. Now, like I said, we can never be assured that this causes you to become immune, but it's a very, very likely scenario. It's unlikely that you could walk out, someone else will infect you with the same virus and you will get sick again. Now, there are people arguing all over Twitter that the virus has mutated and that's what's causing reinfections. I also think that's very unlikely. Coronavirus does not mutate as rapidly as, for instance, influenza. And even influenza is very, very unlikely to have mutated within the average 13.5 days these people getting reinfected. So I think that the drama is largely unfounded, but it's a very serious thing that needs a lot of research. But I would like overall to reassure people, and I really hope I'm right down the line.
It's definitely 5G. It must be the phone masks.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
Shane, your first story was about screens, and I know a lot of parents might be wringing their hands about the amount of time their kids are spending on screens at the moment. Tell me about this research.
Yeah, this is a fantastic study that was done in the United States, and it started, like many good science stories, with two researchers out for dinner having an argument. And rather than just having this standoff, they decided to go and do an experiment. And so they looked at longitudinal data that a statistics body in the US had gathered on children. That's where they take cohorts of children and they stay with them for a period of years and compare two cohorts. So the first cohort of students, we're talking like tens of thousands of young people here, started in 1998 and they stayed with them for 6 years. And then the second cohort started in 2010 and they stayed with them for 6 years. And for each cohort, the children's teachers and their parents were doing observations on the children's social skills. Now, they wouldn't have just been doing random observations. They would have used a protocol. So they would have had a sort of a metric to monitor and to record what the children were up to. And they were looking at things like their ability to form friends, to have self-control, to not have too much of a temper, and to get on with people who were not like themselves. And they found that there was no discernible difference between the two cohorts of children. And this goes back to the original argument that the two researchers had, where the older one said, your younger generation basically has terrible social skills. And he reasoned that computers and screens and exposure to these things was the reason that we were, in his idea, losing our social ability. And so they went and did the big study with tens of thousands of people where they asked parents and teachers, and they found that there was no difference in the social skills of the two cohorts.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a long time ago to me. But I believe this conversation has been had between slightly older parent and slightly younger parent since the dawn of time. That there's always been, whether it's rock and roll or whether it's jazz, or whether it's sharp rock versus dull rock, I think parents for like hundreds and thousands of years have lamented the lack of morals of the next generation.
Yeah, it's called moral panic. So it's this sense, because new technologies come in, that the older generation are worried that the kids have lost the run of themselves. Yeah. This is just this a second cohort, though, is just finished. So they followed the children from 2010 until 2016. So they would have seen an enormous rise in the amount of things like iPads and stuff like that. That all really took off during that time.
Yeah.
And there was one difference, which they found that children who play an extraordinary amount of computer games were seen to be less social than those who did not. But this was really a small effect. So I wouldn't be like, if parents are listening to this, whilst of course I'd prefer that kids are out playing and having a mixture of things in their day, you know, your kids are fine and you're just worried about the younger generation in the same way that your own parents would have been worried about you.
Yeah, I think it's that this conversation is probably even better suited towards the grandparents out there. But yeah, it's good to know. I'd love to see what the next generation, because 2010 to 2016 did not have Fortnite. It didn't have mass gaming in the same way that was online collaborative. It didn't have YouTube streaming. Lara, our third story is about monkeys.
Yeah, this is just a really nice little story, just a short one. It's just shown that they found four teeth in the Peruvian rainforest that have very clearly come from an Egyptian monkey. And I just think it's really class because it's showing that Columbus was not the first primate to make it all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. And what I love is the scenario that they paint in this. So what they say is that these monkeys from Africa most likely were on a vegetation type raft in the middle of a storm, and it broke off from the African mainland. What? Made its way 1500 to 2000 kilometers across the ocean with these monkeys still alive. Then these monkeys made it onto the South American mainland, and they have made it all the way across to Peru in this. They've spent about 2 million years evolving. Then they've died. Then their teeth have become fossilized in the middle of the Peruvian rainforest. And then humans have found them. And I just think it's so wonderful. And it also obviously shows that monkeys did come across from Africa and some of their descendants have managed to cultivate life in South America. But it's more the wonderful series of events that led to it.
That sounds like a very colourful what if to me.
I did wonder if maybe people had just brought across monkey teeth or something like that, but they have evolved since they've been there. They're not identical to the Egyptian monkeys, so it does seem like it's probably true.
Shane, our final story has to do with a new mission, the IM-1. It's not by NASA, it's not by ESA. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I think most spaceflight these days is commercial rather than kind of state-led, which is incredible. So NASA have all these plans to go back to the moon as a staging post to go beyond to Mars, etc. And they have they put out loads of tenders to companies to basically get all the stuff they need put on the moon. And so there's the well-known SpaceX company are going to launch a Falcon rocket in October 2021. And on it, they're going to carry a new type of lunar lander, and it's commercially driven. And when you think of what happened in the 60s, it was so primitive that they weren't able to decide. They couldn't really land where they wanted to land on the moon, and they were just having a go. And now they're able to land within a 200-meter target. Now, considering the moon is a quarter of a million miles away, that is absolutely incredible. And they can bring about 100 kilos of stuff. And then when they land there, they can provide 200 watts of electricity, of power, wow, on the surface to do stuff. So, you know, they're able to, and they have been, bringing things to the moon's surface for a while. And
have doing they? Experiments.
Yeah. So there's like, what do you think of like the Chinese Chang'e mission has been bringing things up there. Plenty of American commercial things have dropped off on the moon, bringing things like spectrometers, etc. This is basically the mechanism by which last week's story about building a giant radio telescope would come true. So they're not going to have astronauts up on the moon building these things. They would bring robots up onto the moon and they would build them, and they'd bring all the science gear that they need to do their experiments.
I didn't realize that we had many successful moon missions over the past decade, because we haven't covered a lot of them in the program.
Well, we don't really care. So can I ask you, who was the first person on the moon?
Who was the first person on the moon?
No, the third person on the moon.
Third person. I have no idea.
To know.
Yeah, nobody knows. And that's why the Apollo missions ran out of money. As soon as we went there, genuinely, the numbers dropped of viewers on TV, and people really don't care unless you're a scientist. Basically, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on and we just don't know about it. It's not in the mainstream media.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You seem like you've used that term mainstream media against me, Shane, which is the first time that's ever happened.
What's that? Like?
Dr. Shane Bergen from UCT and Dr. Lara Duggan, thanks very much. Now, of the five traditional senses, smell is definitely the overlooked and underappreciated hipster's choice. I mean, who would pick sense of smell to keep over any of the other four? And yet, it can be so evocative and so surprising in its impact on us. If you've ever had a smell bring you back to a very specific time or feeling, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. So how does this work? Luca Turin is a biophysicist, group leader in quantum neurobiology at the Fleming Institute in Athens, and author of The Secret of Scent, Adventures in Perfume and the Science of Smell. Welcome to the program, Luca.
Hello.
Would you mind giving us a quick biology lesson on the way smell works? When we crack open a loaf of bread, what's happening in that bread that it speaks to our mind?
So, the first thing you have to know is that the bit in your nose that smells things that come its way is the only part of the brain which is actually outside the skull. It's basically dangling in the breeze. And it's, so these are neurons from the brain that have shot out little tendrils down into your nasal cavity through a bone which is full of holes. And they're waiting for smells to come along. And when you break bread, you release a bunch of, actually quite a complicated mixture of chemicals, the typical complicated mixtures of roasted goods. And they fly up into the nose and they land on the olfactory epithelium, which is really made up of mostly of these neurons. And they cause them to fire off in some pattern, which, once processed by our brain, says bread. And it also says mmm, which is a different story.
Well, what are these molecules? Are they like tiny pieces of bread, like nanoscopic crumbs? Is that what they are?
No, they're much smaller than that. They're actual volatiles, so that basically they're like typically 6-8 carbon molecules. So from one end to the other, the molecules would be barely a nanometer. So a crumb on that scale would be 1,000 times bigger, 10,000 times bigger, even right. The smallest crumb. So no, they're individual molecules.
And they are set free how exactly? How do they end up in the air?
Well, so this is an important point, that odorants in general, that is, odorant is the pretentious term for smelly molecules. Odorants, the reason they leave the bread and fly up your nose is because they have very few things binding them to what's around them. They tend to be rather slippery. In other words, they're volatile. So that typically, if you leave a piece of rock 1,000 years, it's still going to be there. But if you leave out, let's say, a beaker of vodka, it's going to be gone. And that's because the molecules of vodka, of alcohol, of water, make weaker bonds to each other than those of rock, and therefore they fly off. And the ultimate, of course, is things that are gases at room temperature. They just don't even stick to each other unless you cool them or compress them. So we're always, when you're dealing with smell, you're always dealing with molecules that are very slippery.
And is it fair to say that potentially all molecules could smell, but we have evolved just to add a sense to some of them?
Well, so there are a few basic requirements for a molecule to have a smell. It has to be smaller
than a certain... Are these called olfactants? Is that what we call these molecules?
People call them olfactants. People call them odorants. In the fragrance industry, they're called raw materials or aroma chemicals. I think odorants is probably the most neutral term for them.
Right.
So the requirements for them are actually, you know, interesting. I mean, they basically... they cannot be larger than about 18 carbons. Any molecule, when you go up in size, you keep adding carbons and you get all manner of interesting woody and ambery and musky smells and stuff. And then boom, at between 18 and 19, the thing goes dead. There's no smell whatsoever. Huh. And And it can't be that they're not flying off. It's because they're still flying off. I mean, there can't be an abrupt difference. It's all going to be gradual. So clearly what's going on is that the receptors in our nose are no longer able to fit them.
Right.
And a pretty tight size requirement. And so at 19 carbons, nothing. At 20 carbons, absolutely nothing. In fact, you can use a ton of 20 carbon alcohols and have zero smell.
If we think about a dog's nose versus a human's nose, is it that they have more receptors, different types of receptors, or do they have a wider range of molecules they can scent? How do they pick up, a trail from a kilometer away?
I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. I think there may be several things involved. One is, as Richard Feynman famously said, it's easy. Their nose is closer to the ground. so that was one answer. I think the other answer is they seem to have a much bigger olfactory epithelium than we do, four or six times bigger.
That's the bulb also, of the nose, is it?
The actual sensory part is really large.
Right. Okay.
But the other thing, which I think is very important, is that their bones inside their head are arranged in such a way as to guarantee a good flow of air past the olfactory epithelium, which ours are not. So they really extract the maximum amount of smell from a sniff, which we really don't. Mm. And I think that's their secret, really.
So what about this controversial issue of the science of how we smell? I know you have been in a long-standing sort of professional jousting match with other researchers in trying to determine what's actually going on with the molecule and what makes it have that specific sense. Is it shape or is it the vibration that the molecule gives off? So maybe the easier one to start with is the theory you don't subscribe to, which is the idea that the molecules have a certain shape and that's why they have the smell they do.
So that of course is the standard explanation for smell, and I believe in it to some extent, insofar as ultimately shape must determine how tightly a molecule binds to a receptor. If the fit is good, if the molecule is comfortable in the receptor, the binding will be very tight, and that will be a strong smell.
So when you say that, just to drill down, you're talking about a 3D shape of these flying smelly molecules that hit the physical neuron in your brain, and if they clock in like Tetris, you're going to get a strong smell?
Right. Yeah, so basically, if you imagine the receptor be the size of a potato, the molecule will be the size of a pea.
Right.
Okay? But it's not a smooth, round pea. It's a pea with angles and little fridge magnets attached to it. It's going to bind to a pocket in the potato. And if it binds like hell, it will create a stronger reaction than if it binds loosely.
Right.
Now, that tells you how strong an odorant is. But it doesn't tell you what it smells of. And the question of exactly how we distinguish, I mean, bear in mind, humans can distinguish essentially an infinity of smells. I mean, nobody's ever reached the ultimate limit of telling molecules apart.
Okay? Right.
Not only that, but the way we smell them is very peculiar because we can smell their component parts. So that when you give somebody a molecule that is, I don't know, six carbons attached to, let's say, CN, carbon nitrogen, the person will say, I can smell the carbon nitrogen. It smells metallic. And when you take that carbon nitrogen, the CN group, the nitrile group, as it's called in chemistry, and you put it on, let's say, a lemon background, a molecule that would otherwise smell of lemon, you get metallic lemon. You put it on cucumber, you get metallic cucumber, and so on. So we smell analytically, we smell the bits and pieces of the molecule. And that's extremely difficult to explain by a shape mechanism because, in a sense, the shape of the nitrile would be the same as the shape of a million other things. How do we know it's in there?
Right. And so what you're saying is normally for a sense to explain it, saying it was just shape alone, there would need to be one neuron that was shaped exactly the right way for every single smell.
That's right. And well, not exactly. You could always have a combination. You could always have the same odorant, and we know that's the case, binding to different extents to many different receptors.
Right.
And you could in principle assume that the exact pattern of binding determines ultimately what the thing smells of. But that still doesn't explain how you can detect within the molecule particular groups of atoms.
Okay. So this prevailing theory that's in the science of scent is that shape is very important for the type of smell that we give. But you subscribe to a different theory, and that has to do with the vibration of molecules. Can you explain what do you mean by that?
So this is an idea. So molecules are made of masses, atoms or masses, small masses connected by springs. So if you can imagine, if you make a molecular model of a molecule made of atom of masses and springs, and you hit it with a hammer, it's going to make a particular sound.
Yeah.
Okay. And likely a different molecule will make a different sound. It's a bit like musical instrument. So this idea has been around since the 20s that actually what we smell is the way these molecules vibrate. And the unfortunate thing for that theory, which I, by the way, always considered completely bonkers, was that there was no known mechanism for any cell to be able to detect molecular vibrations. And the reason is that the instruments we use to do that are about 2 foot square and a foot high, and they contain all manner of prisms and lasers. And if you look up somebody's nose, you don't see any prisms or lasers. So
right,
that theory was
right.
Was
but there's lots of things that we've recreated from the body that are much bigger because of our lack of ability to recreate that biology. It is, I mean, size is
indeed
not the issue, right?
No, indeed, but optics is a problem. You could never use actual infrared spectroscopy in the body because water absorbs infrared.
Right.
So there was a genuinely deep physical reason for this not to work. So when I discovered, I was always interested in smell, and I discovered that there was, in fact, another way to measure molecular vibrations using electrons, which had been known since 1966. I thought to myself, aha, well, electrons are everywhere in biology. It's easy with the bits and pieces that are given to us as part of the sort of spare parts of biophysics to construct a biological spectroscope from known phenomena. And so that's what I did. But I can tell you that what really convinced me is that this was worth wasting my life on, so to speak, was the fact that when I was in Lisbon on a trip, I calculated on my little hand calculator the frequency of vibration of boron hydrides. So these are BH compounds. Boron is a weird element left of carbon. And they turned out to be identical to the frequency of vibration of sulfur hydrides. And sulfur hydrides is a famous rotten egg smell. So I thought, wait a minute. If boron hydrides vibrate at the same frequency, and they are the only thing that does, then they should smell of sulfur as well. So when I got back to London, I called up a company that makes these boron hydrides that are rocket fuels.
Rocket
fuels?
And
I spoke to them. Yeah, mostly, yes.
Right. Is that not something that's quite dangerous to stick up your nose?
Yeah, indeed, and absolutely. So I called their chief chemist, and I said, could I have a sample? And he said, well, our minimum sample size is 10 tons. So I said, that's not so good.
That's a pretty big sample.
And I said, okay, can you tell me what they smell of? And the line went real quiet. You know, I could hear the hiss. And he says, sir, I try not to smell them. And which is sensible, partly because they're toxic. But then the next day I found out I could order 1 gram of a perfectly respectable borane through Sigma, which is a very common supplier for chemicals. And I got it in the lab. And together with a colleague next door, we opened it gingerly. It doesn't explode. It's fairly safe. And we smelled it, and it smelled intensely of sulfur.
So this is a crazy idea that you are proposing. You're proposing that it's not the shape of the molecules that come off different foods that gives them their smell, but the almost the tune, the vibration that comes off the molecule. And in that way, if, for example, some molecule that was based in carbon or sulfur or any other atom gave off the same vibration, it would smell the same, even though it was a completely different material and a completely different compound?
Yes.
So that obviously is why people don't like this idea, because it's a very wild idea. Because when we think of how we taste, that's very much, it's agreed that we taste shapes, right?
Sort of. You know, yeah, probably, yes.
Right.
Well, but not really, because I'm actually being disingenuous here, because if you consider the sweet taste, lead tastes sweet, thallium tastes sweet, stevia tastes sweet, and sugar tastes sweet, and those things are a factor of 100 in size. So, and what shape does a lead ion have? It's a sphere.
So how do you, or how do they win this battle for good? How do you definitively prove how the human nose smells?
So that's a good question. I think it's easier for the vibrational theory to prove itself than for the shape theory to prove itself, because the shape theory is so amorphous that it makes actually very few predictions. If you look at it, the shape theory just says, well, if you have the right things in the right places, they'll smell right. That's not a theory. That's a hand waving. And in fact, all of fragrance chemistry demonstrates that shape theory doesn't work, because if it did, there wouldn't be 300 chemists in the big fragrance companies. It'd only be three or four or something. So the mere fact that they have 2 9-story buildings with chemists at every floor tells you they don't have a theory. Now, with vibration, it's a bit different, because you can, in principle, imagine an experiment in which you either demonstrate the flow of electrons, just not through the receptor as they're being probed. That's not off the cards. But there are also some more subtle ones that we're working on right now, which use tools of molecular biology to ask which receptors are activated. And these were invented by a brilliant colleague of mine, Makis Koulakis, here in Athens. And we're going to be doing them in the next 6 months to a year. And I think they might actually provide a proper answer. So I expect we will get an answer. There probably is a way of confirming, you know, provide. But actually, let me say this. There's a paper out there from New York City, from New York University, in fact, where they've shown that olfactory receptor neurons can, in fact, in some cases, respond all or none to hydrogen and deuterium odorants. So light or heavy odorants.
What does
identical
that mean?
Shape, different vibration. Well, you take an odorant, octanol, formaldehyde, and you replace every hydrogen atom in the molecule with a deuterium atom, which is identical in size and in shape and orientation and everything, but completely different in vibrations because it's twice the mass. So when you do that, you find that most receptor neurons can't really tell them apart, but a small fraction of neurons in the rat olfactory epithelium can tell them apart, and in fact do tell them apart completely. In other words, only deuterium or hydrogen turns them on. Now, I will say this with absolute confidence, there is no explanation for that fact other than molecular vibrations, even though the authors desperately tried to wriggle out of that during the discussion.
So what you're saying is this particular smelly molecule has exactly the same shape, but a different vibration.
Yes.
And as a result, it smells differently.
That's right. And the neurons perceive one or the other.
Wow. So does that not make you burn with the need to prove yourself right definitively?
Yes, absolutely. Consuming passion, yes, but combined with cold determination, because the trick is to really figure out an experiment which is really unanswerable, you know? And it's not so easy. I mean, some of the things we did, you know, we showed that fruit flies can tell vibrations apart. We showed that humans can tell vibrations apart. But it's always been kind of a loophole. And also remember, I mean, the people who are so dead against vibration are people who don't know any physics and not much chemistry. And therefore, they find the whole idea of electron tunneling really scandalously alien, you know. Now, the fact that all of biology is ultimately quantum mechanics scares the bejesus out of them. They'd rather not think about it. They hope it happens after they're gone. So that's been a problem also.
Luca Turin, author of The Secret of Scent, Adventures in Perfume and the Science of Smell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now, love to know what you made of that. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, and we get your texts and tweets and emails right about now in the podcast. So, we were talking about interstellar travel last week. Really interesting chat with Andreas Hein, who works for an organization that sort of coordinates and funds research looking into how we can manage long-haul space travel in the future. We got a random text in from someone saying, lads, you're talking rubbish about the speed of light, sardines. People are like sardines in the hospital waiting to see a doctor. Where are we going in these times? I mean, my understanding is the hospitals are empty at the moment, but I think you're meaning generally, why don't we focus on the problems that we have on this planet instead of talking about traveling at the speed of light in 2300? Well, it's all relative, isn't it? I mean, you could spend your whole life just thinking about the things that are going on in your own locality, we could have been a very introspective race, but I don't think it's in our genes, is it? It's in our genes to stare at the stars, even if we're all in the gutters. And I think if we didn't have that adventurous spirit, we probably never would have left Africa. The evolution of our species has favored those who are, I suppose, adventurous. And thinking about where we might go in the future is not only a fun thing to do, to be honest, it's a nice distraction from thinking about hospital waiting lists, but also it can inspire other ideas along the way and inspire new materials. And we know that, for example, the trip to the moon created a lot of inventions that were really useful for today. And that's the case that many star projects and even many military projects end up benefiting health care in a roundabout sort of a way. Connor Tobin says, really enjoyed the show this week. Might have helped that I just finished watching Interstellar. The Martian is up next. Martian is way better than Interstellar, so I think you'll enjoy that, Connor. Yeah, no, look, I mean, we do talk about this idea of interstellar travel once in a while in the program, just because it is a thrilling thing to think about, for me anyway. We also got a more formal email in from a guy called Thomas who's listening to the program. He says, dear sir, madam, I think sir might wash for some of the presenters and madam for all in News Talk. I don't know if that's truly appropriate for me. Yo, idiot would probably be a more suitable address. So I'm guessing this person isn't a regular listener to the program. They say, I listened with interest to your program on the radio this morning, which featured a piece on interstellar space travel. Your contributor, I did not make a note of his name, in my opinion, put the cart before the horse. For example, before the massive investments of time and money are devoted to this project, it would be wise to determine whether or not there are planets suitable to human habitation orbiting distant stars. If not, what's the point in undertaking the project in the first place? As well, if habitable planets are actually discovered, it should be determined whether or not they are inhabited by intelligent beings, in all probability far more technologically superior to us humans. Again, what's the point in going there if our explorers are to be welcomed by a hostile reception committee? These facts could be determined by placing high-powered infrared telescopes in outer space, which would settle these matters once and for all before a massive exploration expedition is undertaken. Your contributor's suggestions on how to survive the journey to a distant star, transportation of frozen embryo eggs, robot intelligence, makes absolutely no sense. It could take at least 80,000 years to reach the nearest star at our present state of technology, and then once we reach there, a minimum of 4 years for radio communications to reach back on Earth. our researchers and engineers need to think outside the box when it comes to developing new space travel technology and not rely on World War II stuff, which now governs our space propulsion systems. In order to successfully explore other star systems and planets, our explorers must be able to reach their destinations in days, weeks, or months, but not multiples, thousands of years. Your contributor did not give these matters any thought, instead relying on outmoded 20th century science. Please convey my suggestions to your contributor. I will, because it'd be interesting to see how he takes that. I mean, he is a professional scientist overlooking an institute where they studied this sort of stuff, so I think it's probably unfair to say he didn't give these matters any thought. But he did say, and I think there were plenty of caveats through the piece, in fairness to him, we're talking about a long, long time away. These are the things that we would need to overcome. Here are some of the obstacles. He didn't list all of the obstacles. I do agree, though, that it's probably unwise to send people in a direction and hope that everything's going to work out. I mean, certainly the nature of our world is any threat is killed if it seems to be a threat. If you think about invasive species or just the territorial nature of beings, the chances that we're going to meet aliens who are super friendly and curious to meet us without thinking what do they want and will they murder us all is probably lowish, you'd imagine, given what we know. And then in that case, well, if they've got better weapons than us, will they just kill us all? And this was a question that was probably brought up but ignored when we sent two probes, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, outside into the solar system with a map on them on how to find Earth, which may end up being the most foolish thing we've done if killer alien species find them and manage to decode the GPS coordinates of this planet. I think it's fun to think about these things, and some of the engineering ideas that Andreas Hein put forward were exciting. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and I think Andreas said in the interview, like, once you get beyond 5 to 10 years, you might as well predict that we're all going to be flying space monkeys, because we just can't see that far into the future reliably. But I think some of the ideas are quite interesting, quite exciting. But again, nobody was actually making any real predictions there. We were also talking about COVID-19, and Brian emailed in saying, "Hi, Jonathan, if a virus or COVID-19 can mutate and evolve over time, why is it not considered a living thing?" Brian, it's complicated. Some people consider it a living thing. Other people don't. It depends on how you define life in a way, not to be obsequious, but the definition of life includes a number of different factors, and one of the things, this doesn't have cells, and it doesn't make ATP, the sort of unit of energy that living things do, and it most viruses need something else to survive. So I think there are also arguments to suggest that viruses could be alive. So I don't think it isn't considered a living thing, but it's a good question. We might do a piece on that. Gar says, "Hi guys, can I ask your guest about Korea having discovered reinfection in previously infected and recovered patients? This casts doubt on what is known about this virus." Well, I think there's most proper epidemiologists, immunologists and so on say it's too early to know what we know. And we don't yet realize what the effects are of having gone through the virus. If you can get reinfected by this virus, then we're in big trouble, because we haven't. We're hoping that this virus, once the body's been exposed to it, we build antibodies and we can destroy it with our immune system the second time we get it. If not, then I think the implications without a vaccine are pretty huge. We were talking about the dark side of the moon and putting a satellite there, and Ella from Cork says, "For the love of baby Jesus, would you please stop calling it the dark side of the moon?" I'm open to correction, but I think the dark side of the moon is actually called the dark side of the moon. We're not making that up. There is a dark side of the moon. There's a part of the moon that we don't see. It's the other side. It's dark. I don't know what else to call it. Am I wrong? If you're an astronomer, let me know. That's it from us for this week. You can email your comments to science@newstalk.com on this or any of the comments you've heard before. Love to to get into those conversations with you. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing. Simon Keane was researching. On sound was Peter Malloy. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.